You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Lewis Busby, thanks to a listener named Shannon, who requested that I try to speak to him. Here's the bio on Lewis Busby's website. Lewis Busby was born and grew up in San Jose, California. A fourth-generation California native on his mother's side and a Dust Bowl Okie on his father's, as a kid he had wanted to be lots of different things: an astronaut, a deep-sea diver, a football player, a stand-up comedian, and, of course, a rock star. But when he was a sophomore in high school, a book report changed all that. For that report, he chose John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, even though it seemed like a really long book. After reading the first chapter, he made the very rash decision that he was going to be a writer too, and he has yet to change his mind. Lewis Busby sold his first two short stories when he was a senior in college and has been published and unpublished since then. But of course, you have to make a living, and so he has worked as, in this order, a dishwasher, a bookseller, a publisher, a caterer, and a bartender. He started teaching creative writing in 1994, and since 2000, he's been on the faculty of the MFA program at the University of San Francisco. He lives with his wife and daughter very close to Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, where he's lived for 25 years. It's a great place to live. It's like having a carousel, a playground, a museum, an aquarium, and a forest all in your own backyard. Needless to say, Lewis spends a lot of time reading. And writing, too, which involves a great deal of staring out the window, often while dressed in his pajamas. When I spoke with Lewis Busby, we discussed two of his many books, mainly. The first is The Bridge of Time, and the second is The Yellow-Lighted Bookshop. Here's a quick overview of Bridge of Time, which is for middle grade readers. When best friends Joan Lee and Lee Jones fall asleep at San Francisco's Fort Point during the worst field trip in the history of field trips, they couldn't possibly expect to find what they find when they wake up. The Golden Gate Bridge is missing. Oh, and it's not 2012 any longer, it's 1864. And waiting for them in 1864 is a mysterious stranger, one Sam Clemens. Sam wants to help them get back to their own time, but he also keeps insisting he's Mark Twain, the author of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, books he hasn't written yet. The other book that we discussed in our interview is The Yellow-Lighted Bookshop, and it's a memoir of Lewis's time in bookstores, but also a history of bookselling and publishing from the Great Library at Alexandria to today's City Lights in San Francisco. Mostly, though, the book is meant as a full-on celebration of this common but vital place. If you love the feel of walking into a bookstore and the promise that those stacks and shelves hold, well, I've got a book for you. I started out asking Lewis if there was a particular reason that he made the best friend protagonists in Bridge of Time a boy and a girl.
So for my first middle grade novel, which was Steinbeck's Ghost, the main character was a boy, and for my second middle grade novel, The Haunting of Charles Dickens, the character was a girl. I really want, and in each of those, I found a friends factor to be really important, that I really wanted to write a book about friendship, and having one about a boy and about a girl seemed really interesting to me. But I also remembered being in middle school and having a friend who was a girl, and understanding that you could have this relationship without all of the silliness that went with it. And I think there are a lot more relationships like that in middle school these days than we actually think about. And so I just wanted to play it out and see how it went.
Yeah, I think it's a great dynamic in a book, too, because, you know, you can bring a boy's perspective, you can bring a girl's perspective, and then also your readers, boys and girls, will be able to relate.
Well, that was another thing. I think that we've, in a lot of times in kids' book publishing, we've divided books into genders. This is a girl book and this is a boy book. And I think that's a little bit silly. I get it. It does sort of break down that way, but it might be one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. And I think kids are a little more interesting that way, then we give them credit for sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Early in the book, you describe where they are most comfortable in this way. Off to the side, that was their world. And that's a very brief little sentence about what they were talking about, where they like to be out of the spotlight, off to the side, sort of not right in the middle of everything. And I thought that was such a perfect description of what middle schoolers want. They want to stand off to the side and watch. They're a little insecure. They want to be out of the spotlight. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, there's always a group of middle schoolers who are the popular kids and the kids who are starting their romances earlier than other kids, or are a clique that's well known for some reason. But most middle schoolers, well, at least this was true for me, really kind of get fed up with all of that kind of drama, which is what one of the characters in Bridge of Time calls it. And also just because of their age, you know, they're smart enough to see things, but they're not experienced enough to go into the world yet. And so you get a different viewpoint from standing off to the side. But also for Lee and Joan, who are the characters in Bridge of Time, that just happens to be their character. That just happens to be their sensibility. And that is eventually what leads them into coming unstuck in time and traveling back to San Francisco in 1864, because they like to stand off to the side. They think they can do that forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned the setting, and I wanted to just actually talk about that. For anyone who isn't familiar with San Francisco, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Fort Point and its significance within the city and how you decided this would be a setting in the book.
Well, Fort Point is a Civil War era fort. It actually precedes it a little bit. That was built at the mouth of the Golden Gate. So right now, it's still there, and it's under the Golden Gate Bridge. So a lot of tourists will have seen it if they haven't gone and visited it. But it's a wonderful place. It's right on the ridge of the Pacific, just looking out toward China and Japan. So it's the end of the continent in some ways. You've got this wonderful bridge over you. And it feels like the kind of place where if you're going to come unstuck in time, this is a good enough place. It's between two worlds. It's between the West and the East. It's between the past and the future. And it's just really cool, which has a lot going for it. So there's a little lighthouse on top of it, and it's into that lighthouse that Joan and Lee climb, fall asleep, and then when they wake up, it's 1864.
That's right, and I loved that. It's funny because I wasn't expecting that. I didn't know that's what was going to happen, and so when it did happen, I was like, oh, awesome. It's really fun.
Very good. Well, the other thing about Fort Point for visitors from the East to think about is it's absolutely free all the time. So you get to just walk in and wander around. It's pretty much untouched for over 100 years.
That's wonderful. You know, you go to some of these national sites, and they're so expensive. And, you know, I remember getting very upset when I think we were in Mystic, Connecticut or something, and it was just like, really? We have to pay this much money to see something that is our own national treasure? You know, this is wrong.
So. And when my daughter was very young, we just used to go there because we were really poor, and we would say, oh, well, let's go to Fort Point. And so we wandered around. It's cold. It's a little bit gloomy. It's very, very spooky. And so it has that sense that the past might just erupt at any second. And I think that's probably what led me to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, was it fun? Well, my question is sort of twofold. First of all, was it fun to write a time travel book? And also, is it hard to do this and not repeat literary history? You know, is it hard to make it your own, to do your own time travel book?
Well, when I first proposed a time travel book to my editor, Liz Zabla at Fywell & Friends, she said, oh, Lewis, please don't do that. Time travel is so hard. I said, Liz, how can it be hard? It's time travel. We know it's impossible, and so you get to just make up the rules. She turned out to be absolutely right, of course. It was so much harder than I thought. It took me several drafts to realize that I was using time travel as a device to get them back in a wacky sort of period and then to be able to talk about that. And that's not what I set out to do. I ended up having to force myself to write a book about time. And I've read most of the time travel classics that are out there, and certainly the kids' time travel classics. And what I came to understand for myself was that I don't really believe that time travel is possible or desirable, but that it can happen, that you come unstuck in time. And then as Sam Clemens or Mark Twain makes the case in the book that you're just off, that time travel, which might be reading, it might be the study of history, it might just be the use of your own imagination, being able to see the world from a bigger and more distant place than you do in your regular, ordinary life, that was the real advantage, was to be able to see the world from the side. But he makes the case, Clemens does in the book, that the real focus of time travel is to get back and engaged in the time that you live in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Now, and I loved that he was in it. They come upon a stranger, and, you know, they meet him sort of gradually. Like, he says his name, but it doesn't seem like it really hits Joan and Lee who he is for a while.
They're pretty freaked out. They've woken up in 1864.
Right.
And there's Civil War soldiers running about, and here's this man who's yelling at them and telling them to get down, and he's going to protect them. And so all their stranger danger lectures are coming into the fore there. So when he says the name Sam Clemens, they sort of know who it is in the back of their minds, but they're thinking about much larger issues at that time.
They're trying not to get shot. So,
yeah.
Okay, to give them a break.
And they are eighth graders as well, so it's, you know.
Now, you knew when you started the book that this was going to have Mark Twain in it, right? Because this is sort of part of a trilogy of books about famous authors. Is that correct?
Right. So there's Steinbeck's Ghost, which is about John Steinbeck here, and Salinas, The Haunting of Charles Dickens, which takes place in London in 1862. Neither of those are time travel books. And so in this one, I knew that the writers that I wanted to do were Steinbeck, Dickens, and Twain, because those are writers who loom so large in our public imagination, whether you've read them or not, they're part of the American culture, at least, if not world culture. And they're also the kinds of writers that kids at this age, at 12 and 13 or 14, are just on the verge of reading themselves for the first time. And that's an interesting age group for me to write for, because they're straddling the fence between kids' literature and adult literature. So for me, I first read Steinbeck when I was 15. I first read Twain when I was 14. So it's that age at which you're just about to make that leap.
Now, have you, through the years, reread their work apart from writing about them?
Oh, constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly. Steinbeck is the sort of lodestar of my literary life, and always has been, and I continue to go back to him with great pleasure and deeper envy all the time. Dickens is someone I never get tired of. He is probably the most modern writer that I know of. I think he's so suited for a 21st century audience.
Yeah,
it's so dynamic and so much fun and so funny. And nobody gets tired of reading Mark Twain ever. I think it's a gauge of whether your soul is dead or not, whether you no longer find Twain funny.
Okay. Now, so this was a trilogy, and you've completed that, and you don't anticipate doing more of these?
I don't think so. I mean, I wish it was so successful that the publisher was demanding that I do more. But in light of that not coming to fore, I think I did what I wanted to do. I think each one was different.
Yeah.
They weren't all time travel novels. And I felt like I really looked at the literary life for kids from a different angle. Dickens is at the height of his fame. Steinbeck is just a spirit in the first one. And then Mark Twain, Sam Clemens, is just at the beginning of his career. He's 28. He hasn't yet written any fiction. And he's just about to become that famous person we know as as Mark Twain. And so he's filled with doubts about his own future.
Which I loved. I thought that was so great because he's interacting with these kids who, as we've already mentioned, are insecure at their point in life also.
Well, one thing that I liked to write about in my middle grade novels is a kid's connection to an adult. Mm. An adult who's not necessarily a teacher, an adult who's not a parent. And I had those kinds of interactions when I was a kid. I had adults that I trusted and could talk to and who helped me see the world in different ways. And then also seeing them who, you know, not that much older, 10, 15 years older maybe, seeing them be insecure about their decision, seeing them not know what to do. In some ways, that's a really heartening example to come across.
Mm-hmm.
So you stop thinking of adults as people who know how to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
They're
yeah.
just as confused sometimes and just as lost sometimes as kids are.
And it can be, I mean, it is really helpful if that adult is not your parent, because we have a kind of built-in need, a defense mechanism almost, to see our parents as capable of getting through anything.
Your parents are not going to be that person for you. My daughter, growing up as an only child here, and she's 15 now, in San Francisco, has had the advantage of being surrounded by adults her whole life who are ostensibly her friends. And they're sort of mentors in another way. And she can and does turn to these people for guidance and help and understanding in arenas that she's less likely to come speak to us about.
Yeah, yeah. This is a line from the book. It's just a little line, but it stood out to me. Everyone loved a secret. And I think this is really true, and I wondered if you use this as a truth when you're writing engaging plots for kids or for adults or whatever. Everyone loves a secret.
Well, I think one of the reasons that we read fiction can continue to and will continue to, frankly, despite all the doomsayers out
right.
there, is that it's an opportunity for us to read about the secrets of life that otherwise do not make themselves present. We can read about, it's what E.M. Forster called the secret heart of the characters.
Yeah.
Because we can read a novel about Emma Bovary, for instance, and know more about her than we may know about any other person we'll ever meet, actually. And especially for kids who are in early adolescence, I think secrets are kind of where they live on some level. John Irving said that that adolescence is that time in life when we begin to keep secrets from those people we most love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks really closely to what it's like to be an early teenager.
Yeah. The other great thing about the Forrester quote was he was talking, too, about how in books we get to know all the secrets, whereas in life we don't get to know all the secrets, and so that's what makes it such a pleasure to read about these characters.
And I think it's more than a pleasure. I think it's sort of an essential piece of information. It gives us some sense of security to at least for a moment believe that we've seen underneath the veil of existence for just a moment.
Yeah.
And whatever level that happens to be, whether it's great universal truths about life, whether it's funny sort of social truths about life, like in Jane Austen, whatever it happens to be.
Mm-hmm. When you write fiction, where and how do you tend to start? Like, do you have a little kernel of something that's bothering you and you just start, or do you kind of know more than that?
Usually an idea for a book hits me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to write a book, and I don't necessarily know where it comes from. I want to write a book about a kid trying to save this library. Which is the sort of basis for Steinbeck's Ghost. Then I want to write a novel about Charles Dickens in London in 1862, because that sounds like a really fun thing to do. So I'll get an idea, and then I'll walk around with that idea for a couple of months I usually start taking notes at some point. I do a lot of staring out the window, which is one of the great things about being a writer, because that's considered working.
Yeah.
And then I start to take more and more notes, and then I start to read. And about 6 months probably after that idea first blooms in my head, when the novel is sort of big enough inside my head and I can see the places and I can understand the time that's involved and kind of know who the characters may or may not be. And I've taken a lot of notes on these little tiny pieces of yellow paper. And then I'll actually start writing. And usually by that time I have a clear enough idea that the first draft goes really quickly, 8 to 10 weeks or something like that. And then, of course, then there's draft and draft and draft after that.
Yeah.
So basically, writing is a form of insanity. And reading is the same thing. It's also another form of insanity. You're walking around with a completely imagined and yet completely imaginary world inside your head.
Right.
And you're trying to convince other people that it's real. And then when you're reading, you believe that it's real. So I think this should go in one of the diagnostic manuals.
Yeah, exactly. Do you find it hard to write the middle of a book, or do you find that your early meditative process and note-taking kind of gets you through the middle of the book?
Well, I always start the draft of a book thinking, oh, this is fabulous. I know exactly where I'm going. And then, of course, the map changes, or the terrain changes, or they both change, and then you don't know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't worry too much about the middles when I'm writing them, because I understand from my experience and having written 8 or 9 books that I'm not going to understand anything about the beginning or the middle until I get to the end.
Mm.
But I have to write the beginning and the middle to get to the end. Then I come to understand really what the shape of the book is. And then I can go back and see where my characters have ended up and go back to the beginning and then make a much clearer, although it may take a couple of drafts, sort of arc of how they got there. And that's when the middle starts to get really fun.
Fun.
There's a certain amount of faith involved with writing them, for me, for writing the middle of a book in the beginning.
So when you revise the middle, that's really fun for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I look at it this way. If you don't like revising, you certainly shouldn't be a writer.
No, I know. But I just mean, if you've gone in a direction that didn't actually make sense and you have to kind of re-find that path, is that not frustrating?
No, I don't. I mean, it can be frustrating, sure, because there are certain days where you just want your editor to phone you up and tell you, listen, it's perfect the way it is. And that hardly ever happens.
Or I'm going to fix it myself.
Yeah. Now, it's all taken care of. it is, but then you get in there and you start to realize that what you're doing is you're not fixing the plot.
Mm.
You're understanding the characters better.
Okay.
And that's what's really intriguing to me, is that I'm getting to really understand the characters more by making it a more sound story.
That's a good way of thinking about it. Okay, in Bridge of Time, at one point in the book, Joan and Lee are talking about San Francisco and how it looks to them in another time period. And one of them mentions, or maybe it's just a thought, I don't remember if it's in dialogue, but considers the idea that San Francisco is totally familiar and totally alien at the same time, because of them changing time periods. And when I read that, it struck me that we're often told to try to do this in book, to kind of like present the familiar in an alien way, with a twist, something unusual that will kind of appeal to the reader. And I just wondered if you thought about that when you wrote that line.
I've thought about that a lot. I actually wrote a sort of an epically failed long adult book that took place in the near future. And so I've thought a lot about San Francisco, what San Francisco will be like in the future.
Okay.
But of course, living in San Francisco, you're living, and I was just thinking it this morning as I drove Maddie to school. I was passing by Wooden Victorian after Wooden Victorian, And so here's this very modern city, but it's still at heart a sort of a frontier town. You know, we just built this thing is kind of how it feels. The two live together for me. And I think that when you start to pick out a detail like that and start to focus on the background, if you will, of what's in a city, then you start looking at it in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise I'm just going do-de-do-de-do and I'm going to work and doing my things. And then if I stare up and look at all the decorative gilded eaves and all the houses around here, and I start to see it fresh instead of through habit, it seems to me that that's what reading does also for people, is it makes us, by showing the world in some kind of extremity or some kind of difference or some sort of warped mirror, it makes us see the world again for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if I'm reading about Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Colombia, he's making me see the world, my world, with fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's great. All right, well, I was going to ask you, if you became unstuck in time, where and when would you like to end up? But given the fact that you kind of said the thing about what Sam Clemens says about how you know time travel is really not an appealing concept, I'm wondering if you don't find that an appealing idea. So.
I find it a horrifying idea to time travel, and I'm always baffled by people who say, "Oh, I'd love to live in Dickensian London." No, you probably wouldn't.
No.
You'd probably be dead. You would have had a staph infection at some point, or your mother would have died with you in childbirth, or any time previous to that. It makes good television, but I think it's really hard living. Joan, in Bridge of Time, decides she wants to take a bath, and it takes her about 4 hours to put the bath together.
Right, yeah.
So for me, civilization starts with indoor plumbing, hot and cold running water, and antibiotics. So my time travel capacity is fairly limited.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
And I certainly don't want to revisit my own youth, so.
No, nobody does.
Who wants to do that?
The title, Bridge of Time, actually refers to what happens to the Golden Gate Bridge visually in the fog, you know, that San Francisco is so famous for. And I just loved that. I loved that image and calling it Bridge of Time. So did you come up with the title, or was that the publisher? Or
happily, my editor, Liz Zabla, came up with that. It's an obvious title, and it works. The title I had chosen originally went back to my previous titles, and it was creaky and rickety and not very good. And she said Bridge of Time, and I went immediately, yes. Because the bridge does appear and disappear
right
in San Francisco. And you know what? The bridge hasn't been there for that long. It's only 1937 when it was built. And so it does this thing in the fog where it appears and disappears. And also, in all of my books, I've always made a little, my middle grade readers, a little bit of an homage to Madeleine L'Engle and Wrinkle in Time.
Mm.
And so there's a little bit of that in there as well.
Yeah, I love that book.
It's a good book.
Oh my gosh, it's such a good book. Well, actually, so Lewis, we're going to talk about two books today. Speaking of Madeleine L'Engle, brings us to, you know, favorite reads of all time and our love of books and our love of bookshops, and that brings us naturally to your other book, or another book that you've written, The Yellow Lighted Bookshop. This book seems to be a loving toast to books and their place in your life, but also to certain bookstores and booksellers who educated you and helped you find your path. Would you say that's true? I mean,
oh, absolutely. I was very fortunate, or not, it's hard to say, at the age of 18, having already decided to become a writer and made that bad choice my next bad choice was to get a part-time job in a bookstore to support myself through college. And I immediately fell in love with the task of bookselling. I mean, everything from, you know, the large First Amendment issues that surround bookselling to the small things like shelving and alphabetizing. I really just fell into it with a great delight. And part of that was abetted by the fact that I was working in a bookstore where there were a group of older women, that they were probably in their 40s and 50s, and I was 18, who were very experienced booksellers and took me under their wing and taught me everything they could teach me about bookselling. And a lot of that included the study of children's literature, how important that is in the publishing community, mm-hmm. how important that is in our culture, if you will, simply because of what it promotes. And they had me read and come to understand that as an adult, that children's literature was this vast and complex and sophisticated literature. And because of that, I began to study kids lit as an adult, and I've studied it ever since. So when I began writing my first middle grade reader, which came out in 2008, I was actually kind of late to the game, but there's that kind of informal mentoring that goes on in bookselling, and I saw it at every level of bookselling, from just being a clerk, and then all the way up to I was working in publishing at the end. That really harkens back to a sort of almost a guild kind of life, where mm-hmm. you are an apprentice for a while, and then you study under masters, and they move up. And of course, the great thing is that nobody's getting paid anything.
Right, right. So it is definitely a labor of love.
Absolutely, and that's an interesting and troubling passion to find it at an early age.
Yeah,
it could have gone the other way. So,
did you find that a lot of the people who gravitated to that industry, bookselling specifically, not so much necessarily publishing, but bookselling, were writers?
Oddly enough, no.
No.
No, oddly enough, no. There's always one or two people on a bookstore staff who are either writing or secretly writing.
Okay.
And the same is true in publishing that I found. There's always a few people here and there in the company who are writing or want to, or taking classes or have this secret novel. But I found mostly that most writers I've known have not liked working in bookstores because the pay is miserable and it really cuts into your time.
Yeah.
And what I found is that most booksellers are people who passionately love books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. May I read a paragraph from the book?
Oh, yes, please.
And then we can talk about it. I loved this. It made me think about bookselling in a new way, although it's not like, I don't know why I hadn't thought about this. But anyway, part of the allowable leisure in a bookstore comes from the product it sells. Books are slow. They require time. They are written slowly, published slowly, and read slowly. A 400-page novel might take years to write, longer to publish, and even after the novel is purchased, the reader can expect to spend hours with it at one sitting over a number of days, weeks, sometimes months. I loved that. And it explained for me something I hadn't put together before, and that is that part of the problem with books today is that everybody wants fast, 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 more, more, faster, faster. Immediate gratification seems to be what rules us these days, which I think probably is something to do with why the book industry is changing and is in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, I also think it will be what saves the book industry.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, because a book cannot be made faster, actually. I suppose you could get an audio book and sort of turn up the speed on it, have it go more quickly, and you could be done with it in 2 hours instead of 6 hours. But books, just by their design, by making you slow down, by making you spend that time just alone, sort of ensconced in that book, do something that other forms of art don't necessarily do.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen to a record 50 times over, and you're never going to do that with a book. Maybe one book in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at a painting again and again and again. You can look at a painting in an instant. You can't do that with a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I hear the need for speed coming through our commercial channels, which is, oh, and the internet is now even faster, and I'm thinking, seriously? How much faster can it get?
Right.
If it gets faster, we're going to start going backwards at some point. I think that will be the thing that is going to keep books a part of our culture, is that some people will continue to want to slow down and just sit with a book. My friend James Preller, who's a terrific kids writer, says that books are for people who aren't afraid to be bored. And I really like that.
I like that too.
And what I see around me in the need for speed is people who really don't want to be bored for half a second.
Yeah.
And some of my great moments in life are spent, as I said earlier, staring out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a tree and some cars outside my window. It's not like a great window.
So. Like you're not looking at the Bridge of Time.
Yeah, no. It's 7th Avenue, so yeah.
So I was wondering when I read The Yellow Lighted Bookshop if it started out maybe as a journal. It's such a mix of things. It's history and memoir and reflection and business sense. And I just wondered how you came to write the book and did it sort of start out that way? Or
no, I had known for a long time that I wanted to write a book about bookstores. I wanted to write a book about new bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the literature about bookselling tends to deal with antiquarian or used bookselling, or it deals with a specific bookstore, usually with some sort of literary celebrity attachment to it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to write about this what used to be a very common place, which is the bookstore. And you would go to the bookstore and buy a brand new book, and people spent a lot of time there. And having worked in bookstores for a long time, I knew how much people loved it. So when I set out to write it, part of the reason that I made it a hodgepodge of things is that I didn't want to prize my experience in the bookstore as something really worthy of a book. I was a good bookseller, but I wasn't Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I didn't start City Lights. I was just a bookseller. And so I knew that I needed some of my personal experience in there in the hopes of triggering the same kind of feelings and ideas in the reader. So I used part of my own experience, but then part of the history of bookselling as well, to try and build what I hope is a complex portrait of a really common place.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing extraordinary about it except that it's extraordinarily ordinary. And I think people really understood that when they read the book.
Well, it's ordinary, but it's also in a little bit of trouble. So, you know, I felt like it was honoring something that should be valued at this time when it's being judged in a way.
One of the interesting things for me is that I knew it was elegiac when I was writing it. I did not think it was going to be the obituary it looks like.
No, and
might be.
No,
because things have changed so rapidly. When I published the first edition in 2006, the ebook, the Kindle, was nothing.
Mm.
It was the minorest part of the bookselling world, and it really didn't look like it was going to take off. By 2008, when the paperback came out, it was starting to make a move. But by 2010, when the electronic version came out, which I still think is a weird idea, that there's an electronic version of this book, ebooks, were fully a third of all book sales.
Yeah.
So that change happened so fast. In terms of whether the bookstore will go away or not, well, booksellers are always looking for hopeful signs. I think the loss of Borders as a chain was a huge blow to the country,
yeah.
a huge blow to the publishing industry. There are more and more independent bookstores opening up these days, which is really great.
Yeah.
And I think what's happened is booksellers have found that there's a need for people to get out of the house and stop clicking their mouses, if only to go shopping, and that the bookstore is still a place where you can do that. The other upside, I think, to the whole distress that the industry is in is that publishers have started to spend a lot more time and effort and money on making books into these beautiful objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go into a bookstore now, you can get these fabulous editions of the classics or even brand new books that are just so well made and so visually and sensually interesting, as if to say, okay, well, we can't compete with the electronic content, but we can show you what a physical book can do in a way that an electronic book cannot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a kind of funny experience reading your book, and so I've on the show. I'm going to have a new segment on the show every couple of months. I'm going to sit down with a bookseller and talk about some books that she recommends for the next couple of months. And the woman who I'm speaking with is named Claire Benedict, and she owns Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. I'm in Vermont, right? So I'm reading your book, and I'm like, oh my god, he loves Bear Pond Books.
absolutely, the Bear Pond that I first knew. I've been to Bear Pond since it moved. That was like on the other side of the street.
Right, right. Well, that's where Rivendell Books is, and the same owners own Rivendell, and that's the used bookstore that they own.
Great.
And Bear Pond is the new. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So I told Claire this morning when we did that first segment this morning, and I said, "Oh, my next interview is with somebody who loves Bear Pond Books." I really enjoyed your reflections, and we already talked about this a tiny bit, your reflections about adults getting to the children's literature section of the bookstore. Adults who don't even necessarily have children who should, like, reacquaint themselves with children's literature, either the older literature or the new stuff, and just how much fun it is. I thought that was a great aspect of the book, just advice-wise.
If there's one aspect of publishing that gives us a lot of hope right now. The arena in which there's the most growth, it's middle grade and young adult novels. And that's primarily because adults are reading them as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's certain restraints on kids' literature that forced the writers, when they're doing it right, to do it very, very well. And there's a certain amount of the bullshit factor in adult literature that you can get away with. As if I confuse you enough, then it must be interesting and literary. And you can't really do that with kids' books because they'll call you on it.
Right. Yeah. And another thing you mentioned was just what a great starting resource nonfiction books for kids can be for adults who are beginners in an area. So, if you want to learn a little something about, I don't know, car mechanics, you can go read a kid's nonfiction book about car mechanics and get started there. That seemed like such a great idea to me.
Well, it's a piece of advice I got from Gene Shalit, who used to be...
Oh, wow. Gene Shalit.
Film critic on the Today Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Bushy hair and the big mustache,
right.
He used to do a books roundup at Christmas every year on the Today Show. And I first heard this idea from him, which is if you're interested in a subject and you want to learn something about it, start with a really good, preferably picture-filled book about that from the kids section and use that as sort of your entry into further study of the subject, whether you are indeed interested in it, and just as a way to sort of get the basics of something, car mechanics would be a great place to start.
Right.
Why would I want to read about the history of the carburetor when I don't even know where it is on the car or if they have them anymore?
Exactly.
So show me a picture of an engine and kind of how it works, and then I can take it from there.
Right.
It's you're sort of imitating what school does. I'm going to start with the basic ABCs of something and work my way into the complex, the complex patterns of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it struck me that it would work for writing, too, for adults who want to start writing and haven't done a lot of writing, you know, since they were kids. They could start with books for kids about how to write, you know.
Sure,
I mean,
absolutely.
Books for teenagers, maybe, about how to write.
Yeah, no, or even books for kids.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with going back to school in its most basic forms. A couple of years ago, I took a drawing class, and I had no experience with drawing. And it's called Everyone Can Draw. And, you know, we learn to draw things like cubes,
yeah,
spheres. You know, and we started way back at the beginning. We didn't set out to draw the Manhattan skyline. We just said, nah, let's draw a ball.
Yeah, yeah. Lewis, I wanted to ask what you are reading these days.
Yes, the proverbial question. Well, I'm reading everything. As I always do, I worry about myself a little bit. It's still such a great pleasure in my life. But I was thinking about it. So I just finished a terrific young adult novel by Brian James.
Okay.
Called Life is But a Dream. And the writing in this book is so incredible, and so original. It is the kind of book that adult readers should be picking up. I love that book. I do a lot of rereading. I just finished rereading 100 Years of Solitude for the first time in 30 years.
Yeah.
And that was as mysterious and lovely as it was the first time, but so much sadder than it was the first time. And I think that's just the difference between reading it when you're 20 and reading it when you're 50.
Yeah.
And I just finished a book of stories by Dagoberto Gilb, G-I-L-B, who's an L.A. and Texas-based writer who's sort of the Southwest version of Raymond Carver. He's been around for a long time, but I just love these stories, working-class people trying to make their way in the world. He's a terrific writer. So those are my three most recent. And then, as it turns out, today's the day I have to go buy a new book.
Oh, enjoy.
I will. I always do.
Now, where...
I have a lot of books here, but I need to go buy one today. So.
Well, actually, before I go on to that, what's the name of the stories, the collection of stories?
The Magic of Blood.
The Magic of Blood, okay. And then what is your favorite bookstore these days? Where will you be going to buy that book?
Well, it's a toss-up. My favorite bookstore in the whole world is still City Lights Books here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I got to get there, and I got to park, and I got... It's... I love it, but it's... I got to go to my neighborhood bookstore when I'm feeling like this. And so in my neighborhood, I've got two great bookstores, the Booksmith on Haight Street... just one of the great bookstores in the city, and that's all new books. And then Green Apple Books, which is over on Clement Street, and that's a new and used store. And so the new book selection is terrific, but it's one of those used stores. It's, you know, three huge floors filled with books and stacks of books and so, you know, it depends on my mood.
Okay.
Where that will take me. Yeah. But I'm feeling like a new book today, something I can get that new book smell out of. So maybe
I love that feeling.
Yeah.
It's like this feeling of so much promise. And then also I wanted to ask, what are you working on these days? What are you writing?
So I'm about halfway through my first young adult novel. So my previous kids' books have been middle grade, so for 9 to 14. This is young adult. It's 14 to whenever. It kind of matches. I'm kind of following my daughter's age as she grows up. so it's a completely different world because you can have sex, drugs, and rock and roll in a young adult novel. And this, appropriately enough, is called Garbage Hill. And Garbage Hill is the name of a fictional one-day music festival, and six different teens come to this 20,000-person one-day music festival all separately, and they all end up going home together.
Oh, okay.
Because when you're a teenager, a 14-hour music festival, that's an entire lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Garbage Hill, where does that happen?
It takes place sort of, there's a big music venue in down by San Jose called the Shoreline Amphitheater, and they turn it into these five stages.
Okay.
This one-day festival they have, and so I've done that. I've added some stuff to it, and I'm making it into sort of the coolest music festival ever.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, good luck with that. So my last question usually for writers is some piece of advice that my guest has to offer to writers. In your case, though, I was thinking I might ask you to offer a piece of advice for book lovers, whether or not they're writers.
You mean in terms of them and their relationship to books?
Yeah, books, bookstores, finding books these days, and possibly writing them, too.
Well, you know, I've taught writing now. After bookselling and publishing, I've taught writing for the last 19 years to a variety of different audiences, and I really love it. And the one thing that I know for sure is that veterate readers, people who love to read, who read all the time, almost all of them somewhere inside are holding on to this idea of, oh, yeah, I could write a book.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do that. And what I want to tell them is that they just need to start. It's going to take a long time, et cetera, but everybody has some spark of promise in them that way. And everybody has a book in them. I know that for a fact. And I know that so many of the adult students who come to me have had at some point a teacher or a friend or an editor or an agent say, oh, that'll never happen, blah, blah, blah. And that shuts people up. And frankly, I would rather just have everybody writing their own books. And I think if you go forward with the understanding that you're going to write some really horrible things before you actually write anything good,
right.
That talent is something that you develop and not something that you possess. If you go in with that understanding, then I think you'll have fun, and I think you'll surprise yourself with the things that you write. I have never been one. I came from a very working-class family and sort of stumbled on literature by accident, and I've never been one to think that, oh, literature is something these people do over here. No, I think it's something we all need to do, and I think it benefits all of us to record something of our own testimony of life on this planet. So I would, my recommendation would be read a lot of books and just write a short story.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Okay. That's great. That's great advice. Thank you. Well, Lewis, this was just a pleasure. I enjoyed reading your books and I enjoyed speaking with you about them. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much for having me today. It's always fun to talk about books.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lewis Busby. Many thanks to Shannon, the listener who requested that I try to make contact with Lewis for an interview. You can learn more about Lewis Busby's work at his website, lewisbusby.com, and his first name is L-E-W-I-S. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic gigabit network. And VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Lewis Busby. He calls this the memory thief, and it's a timed writing exercise. the memory thief is on his way to your house. You have just 10 minutes before he gets there. You get to keep any of your memories that you manage to write down before he arrives. Anything that you don't get on paper is lost to you. So write madly without censoring yourself or taking any time to edit. Lewis says that wonderful, weird images will come out of this prompt, and people almost always start in childhood. Which doesn't mean that you have to. It's just an interesting thing he's noticed in his students' work. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org on Mondays from 2 to 3. And archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. As I mentioned earlier, my interview today with the author Lewis Busby happened thanks to the request of a listener named Shannon. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.